Goodman tonight to bring us his thoughts. The title of his talk is, Who Was That Hero? Who was that hero? Brother Bob?
Well, good evening, brethren. We've certainly had a wonderful convention, wonderful theme tests, and many good talks from the platform. Before we get started this evening, we wanted to bring the love of your brethren in Orlando. They all voted to do so, and so it's my privilege to do that. We brought a lot of them with us, too, or some of them preceded us, actually. And so we're very happy to be here in convention with each and every one of you. We also bring love from the International Convention. It was Cheryl and my privilege to attend that just a little over a month ago. And, of course, they voted to send love to all those we came in contact with. And then last weekend, it was our privilege to be in fellowship with the brethren in St. Petersburg, Florida, and they voted to send their love as well. So we have all of that. Before we get started, we also wanted to thank the Huntsville brethren for putting on this very wonderful convention. I can tell you, being on a convention committee, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of sacrifices, Brother Paul talked about today, but it is a blessing to each and every one of us here. And so we are very, very thankful for all of your efforts. We know that it is a blessing, and all those in attendance have received a blessing as well. A couple of years ago, I attended a movie with my kids. It was entitled The Phantom. I don't know if you saw this movie or not, but it was based on a comic book hero. And the Phantom was this mysterious character who wore a mask throughout most of the movie. And throughout the movie, those around him, when he would come in and do his good deeds, would say, well, they would wonder, who was that hero? Well, that was a comic book hero. And, of course, we as Bible students are really not interested in the Phantom or comic book heroes, and we're not even really interested in Olympic heroes or other heroes. We're more focused on biblical heroes. And so that's going to be kind of the focus of our thoughts this evening. A hero is described as a person of great courage and great spirit, and especially one who has undergone great difficulty or danger. You know, we have a great desire to learn more about heroes, and just recently in Orlando, we've been studying on our Monday night study the 11th chapter of Hebrews. We've now gone on to the 12th chapter and beyond, but we were studying the 11th chapter of Hebrews, which all of us know is the Heroes of Faith chapter. And we looked at many of those heroes of faith. They're listed in the first 31 verses of that 11th chapter. They include Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Joshua, Israel, Rahab, and many others. What do we know about these individuals? Well, if you think about the list I just gave you, most of them have either chapters or entire books written about the details of their lives. But there's one individual, you've got the handout, that we have very little reference to, and that's this individual named Enoch. Why would the Lord put Enoch in this Heroes of Faith chapter, if he didn't give us much information? You know, this kind of intrigued me, and this is what initially started me on this subject. Why would he put him there if he doesn't give us much information? And when we look at it, we find that there are only 11 verses in the Scriptures that directly refer to Enoch. This is great. We can read everything we know about Enoch right now. We'll start in Genesis, in the 5th chapter, 18th and 19th verse, and the 21st through 24th verses. And Jared lived 162 years, and he begat Enoch. And Jared lived, after he begat Enoch, 800 years and begat sons and daughters and so forth. Then skipping down to the 21st verse of Genesis 5. And Enoch lived 65 years and begat Methuselah. And Enoch walked with God after he begat Methuselah 300 years, and he begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. That's the Genesis account. He's mentioned again in 1 Chronicles 1:3, and this is just in a lineage where he's called Henoch and Methuselah and Lamech. So it's just another reaffirmation of the same genealogy that we have in the 5th chapter of Genesis. We also have this reaffirmed in the Luke account. We find this in Luke 3:37. Where Luke is giving us an account of the lineage of Mary. And here he says, which was the son of Methuselah, which was the son of Enoch, which was the son of Jared, which was the son of Mahalalel, which was the son of Canaan. So once again, reaffirming for us in our minds this lineage. Then we skip down into Hebrews in the Heroes of Faith chapter. This is Hebrews 11 and 5. And the Apostle Paul mentions him here as one of the heroes of faith. And here's what he says. By faith, Enoch was translated that he should not see death, and was not found because God had translated him. But before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. The last two verses on Enoch are found in Jude. Of course, there's only one chapter, verses 14 and 15. And Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000 of his saints to execute judgment upon all and to convince all that are ungodly among them of their ungodly deeds which they have ungodly committed and of all their hard speeches which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. That's it. End of lesson? I don't think so. We have to look at what is revealed. So we're going to do a little analysis. By my career, as I'm a computer analyst and database administrator, so let's do a little analysis and find out really what do we know. You know, on the surface, these 11 verses don't give us much information. But let's dig a little farther. We know about his lineage. That's related in the Genesis, the Luke, the Chronicles, and the Jude account. We know about his faith, related to us in the Genesis, Hebrews, and Jude account. We know about his prophecy. We find this in the Jude account. And we find clues about his death in both the Genesis and the Hebrews account. Well, is that all we know? You know, sometimes when we have a subject like this, we have to delve a little farther. So we said, well, let's look at each aspect. Let's look first at his lineage and find out what we really know. I mean, we've been given these begats and begats and begats and sons and daughters, but let's find out, dig a little deeper. Now, when we speak about lineage, we are speaking about family. How many of you here knew your grandparents? How many here have known your great-grandparents? How many here have known your great-great-grandparents? Anyone? Well, what about Enoch's family? We know that during his life, at one point he knew his son Methuselah, his grandson Lamech, his father Jared, his grandfather Mahalalel, his great-grandfather Canaan, his great-great-grandfather Enos, his great-great-great-grandfather Seth, and his great-great great-great-grandfather, Adam. How do we know that? Well, when we line up the begats, I didn't know that. I didn't find that in the verse. But the information that they gave us, if we put it in a chart, it reveals this. And lineage, I'll tell you, was very important because if you look, there's more information given about his lineage than any other single aspect of his life. So what we did is we took the chart on the top that you don't have, which is the begats, and when they begat, and how long they lived, and we put it in the chart on the bottom, which is what you do have. And these are relative lines. So if you go vertically up, you see that during Enoch's life, which is the shortest line on this chart, you can see all of the people that were alive during his life. And also when he lived relative to other events like the flood, which is the vertical dashed line. Okay. I found this helpful in looking at this. You know, it's interesting to note, when you look at this chart, it is fair to say that during Enoch's lifetime, he knew the majority of people that had ever lived. Kind of an interesting thought. But it's also interesting to look. He was outlived by his grandson, by his son, by his father, by his grandfather, by his great-grandfather, by his great-great-grandfather, and by his great-great-great-grandfather. In fact, when you look at the chart, Adam was the one who died before he left the scene. Notice also on this chart gives you not the details, but it shows you visually the overlaps on the line. So if you want the details, I could give you this chart or you can add up the begats and figure out when each started and ended. We know that Enoch also was the seventh from Adam. And that's a fact that was especially emphasized in Jude 15. It must have been significant. He was the seventh. Keep that in mind. What does the number seven mean? We'll follow up on that in a little bit. Another couple of interesting points on this little particular chart really shows the patriarchs. We want you to also note that only one of the patriarchs crossed that flood line. Now, I will tell you that it looks like Lamech came real close, or Methuselah. Lamech was actually, by calculations, about 4 years before the flood, and the suggestion is that Methuselah actually died just a few months prior to the flood. The average age of these patriarchs, and we're going to exclude Lamech because we feel in his case the Lord was setting up another arrangement and he had to leave the scene, perhaps prematurely. If you exclude him and Enoch, who is also a special case, the average age of the patriarchs was 929 years. Even Noah himself lived 950 years. Those are long lifetimes. I didn't really, when you start doing the begats, you don't really realize that necessarily. So that, we have some thoughts on his lineage. Now what about his faith? Faith is another important thing. Well, his faith was a very, very strong aspect of him. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been mentioned in this 11th chapter of Hebrews, would he? There are two individuals who had a very special relationship with God. Remember, we were talking about justification and justified unto friendship with God. Well, there are two individuals that had very close relationships with God, to the point to where they were described as walking with God. And one of those individuals was Enoch. Now, there's also another mention of walking with God, and that was with Adam. Remember, God came to him in the cool of the evening and spoke with him? But that arrangement changed. But with Enoch, the conclusion in Genesis 5:24 is, and Enoch walked with God. This was a special relationship. The other individual that's mentioned as walking with God is Noah. And we find that in Genesis 6, verse 9. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. So we have two individuals that are specifically stated as walking with God, and these are two patriarchs, Enoch and Noah. What does this walking with God mean? Kind of reminded me of, when you come across this phrase, it reminded me of Deuteronomy 10:12. What doth the Lord God, thy God require of thee, but to fear the Lord thy God, and we realize this is reverential fear, to walk in his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul. So here we have an illusion of walking in his ways, walking with God. Now when I started to read that, you probably thought, he's reading Micah 6:8. Right? That's very, very similar to this Deuteronomy 10:12. What doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God? Micah 6:8. You know, both of these scriptures combined show different aspects of the walk. Reverence, walking with him, and when you're walking with him, my wife reminds me of this because we walk and run together, you've got to stay with the person, you can't leave them. Love, service, and really the embodiment of faith. This is what really is meant here by walking with God. It includes actions, justice, mercy, zeal, love, a progress, because when you're walking, you're going somewhere, aren't you? Not standing still. It's going in a direction and going with this individual. Patient endurance and obedience. And it really suggests that they were in a fellowship with God. They were in, as Brother David said, they were up there on end, in communication with God. They had a relationship with God. Let us ponder this as well. Why was this only ascribed to these two individuals? Wasn't ascribed to Adam? Wasn't ascribed to Methuselah, Enos, or any of the others? It's a rare thing, this walking with God. And it suggests that they walked with God despite the world and family around them. So it was an exceptional thing. It also suggests that it was a very unique thing. The Apostle Paul mentions Enoch as one of the heroes of faith when he says, by faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death, that he pleased God. So walking with God is pleasing him, is what we could conclude. Kind of reminded me of the scripture, bless the Lord, O my soul. The basis of pleasing God is faith and obedience and following God's will. What did he do that was pleasing to God? And how did he merit this special fellowship that he had with God? These are some of the questions that we don't necessarily have concrete answers on. But we do know that he was an example. And we do know that he was described as a hero of faith. And we look forward in the kingdom to come of finding out those answers. What about his prophecy? That was another aspect that we talked about. This is really relayed to us in Jude 14 and 15, where we read, and Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000s of his saints. And the comment book calls this his holy myriad, to execute judgment upon all and to convince all that are ungodly among them of their ungodly deeds which they have ungodly committed and of all their hard speeches which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. If that was the prophecy from the platform here, condemnation of ungodliness and sin in the world, what would be the reception here? I think the brethren would say, hallelujah! Wouldn't we say hallelujah in New Orleans? We would. Because we realize it's a sin-sick and dying world. This was Enoch's prophecy. What was the response by those around him? Well, I think it's the same response that we'd get if we went out in the world and condemned ungodliness. We wouldn't be received very well, would we? Being a prophet has never been a popular job. We know that Enoch was a prophet. He prophesies, it says it right here. We know that this was not received well. You know, traditionally, when I started this study, I used to think that on the timeline here that the corruption occurred right before the flood. But there's a suggestion here, and it's implicit, that maybe that wasn't the case. Look where Enoch is on the line here. He's about halfway to the flood, his lifespan. If his message and prophecy was not received, if he was reviled and rebuked, then obviously there were some things happening on the scene, perhaps a little sooner than we had thought. I believe it's in the fourth chapter of Genesis we have an alternate chronology. This one's not of the patriarchs. But of a different chronology. And the suggestion was that when Cain was cast out, and it just kind of goes through his lineage, that this was where the fallen angels attacked first. Right? Go sow where the seeds will reap. These people were farther from the fall due to the act. They had been cast out, put out of favor. So logically, Satan, he's smart. He would work on them first. And they were in a region adjacent to where Enoch resided. And so the suggestion is, and it's implicit, is that that had started to flow over. And some of that iniquity had started to invade. Remember, these people lived a long time. So they had a lot of opportunity to be corrupted. We know further that he was received among a corrupt generation. And we have that now in the 11th chapter of Hebrews and the 13th verse. And we didn't quote this one to start with because it doesn't directly refer to Enoch, but it does collectively refer to Enoch. So if you'll turn to Hebrews 11:13, it states, "All these died in the faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed them, and they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth." These heroes of faith were strangers in an ungodly world. Let's give you another reinforcement, perhaps, of this concept. You know, as Bible students, we love to look at names. And so I started looking at these names of all the patriarchs. And let's look at how these names perhaps infer and show man's descent. And we're going to skip Enoch, whose name meant dedicated, and according to another source, meant consecrated. We're going to skip Enoch, but let's look at Noah. Noah meant rest. Let's start with Adam. Adam meant red. Seth meant substitute. Enos meant man. Canaan meant possessor. Mahalalel meant praise of God. And then Jared, Enoch's father, his name meant descent. Kind of interesting. Did you notice how we just changed? Methuselah, according to some surface sources, his name, if you look at the expanded out meaning, means when he dies, it will come. Look back on our chart. When he dies, it will come. What came when he died? The flood. And Lamech meant destroyer. Did you see the change? Did you see with Jared, we really started a descent pointing towards the flood. So I think we have another just implicit implication that perhaps things were corrupt and that this decline of mankind started maybe a few years prior to where we had supposed during Noah's day. Fourth thing let's look at. What about his death? You know, on the surface this seems very straightforward, but then the Apostle Paul just throws us a curve. And Brother David is smiling because this is a curve. By faith, Enoch was translated that he should not see death. And he was not found because God had translated him, for before his translation he had this testimony that he pleased God. You know, personally, I would have been much more satisfied just to have the Genesis account where it says he died, where he was taken away. But how do we harmonize this? We've got New Testament saying it was translated, whatever that means, and the Old Testament saying it was taken away. You know, this has been a point of some contention, I found out, as I've given this talk. So let me give you my observations on this. How do we true up these two statements about his leaving the scene? Well, there was one interpretation I heard that I really liked. One interpretation was that no one died during Enoch's life. And you know, I really liked that because he only lived 365 years. He was a relative youngster, right? And that would have been very nice, except for the chart. You look at the chart, who died during his life? Adam. Oops. Well, and since they were kind of close back then, closer than a small town in Alabama, I'm sure that everybody knew that Adam had passed from the seed, so we can't really say that he didn't see others' death. So that's not probable. Another explanation that I heard that I don't really go along with, but will offer, is that he did not die and went straight to heaven. Oh my goodness, that's a couple of brethren in the back, I think, stood up when I said that. That's at odds with basically all the basic doctrine. The wages of sin is death. It goes against our understanding of hell, the soul, Christ being the first fruit, and the statements of the ancient worthies having a slightly lower estate than the church. Different arrangement, not because of worthiness, but because of when they lived and the arrangement they were under. Yet a third. So I don't think, you know, let's not even consider that. And the third was that somehow Enoch was held in suspended animation or some type of state. But, you know, that gives us a little problem too. In the day that thou sinnest, thou shalt surely die. Year for a day. Thousand-year day. Like we said, none of the ancient worthies, none of the people that were recorded lived over 1,000 years. And also the fact that Enoch was under that Adamic death sentence, as is all the world of mankind. Leaves us with a question, where do we go from here? Next speaker? No. We'll delve a little further. Let's go back to the Genesis account and see what we know. You know, as an analyst, sometimes we get in a situation where we don't know where to go. So we go and we assess everything that we know and everything we don't know, and then maybe we can make some good assumptions. So we're going to go back to Genesis 5:24, which I like. I like that. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not. That's the statement there. Now, what does this expression, he was not, mean? Well, we can look at other biblical examples. You know, this was an expression used in several places in the Old Testament, and I think they give us a clue as to really what this means. Reuben expressed this very same thing when he returned to the pit to find his brother Joseph. And you know what? He thought he was dead. And this we find in Genesis 37:30. And he returned to his brethren and said, the child is not. And whither shall I go? He was distressed. Example number one. Later in Genesis, Jacob used the very same expression. And in a very similar context, and we find that in Genesis 42, verse 36. And Jacob, their father, said unto them, "Me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away." What is he saying here? What was his assumption about Joseph? And what was the actual condition of Simeon? We're talking about death. You know, vines suggest that when this expression is applied to human existence, it means going to one's death. And that's consistently what is shown in the Old Testament scriptures. But if you're still not convinced, we have some other proofs along these lines. And this we really read, we have to turn back to the 11th chapter of Hebrews. I hope we haven't run out of fingers. And this we have the Apostle Paul speaking about Abel and Enoch and Noah and Abraham and Sarah. And this is in the faith chapter, and it's once again Hebrews 11, 13. And it's kind of interesting if you highlight in your Bible in this Hebrews chapter, which I have done, in yellow highlighter, let me read it, the abbreviated chapter. By faith Abel, by faith Enoch, by faith Noah, by faith Abraham, by faith Sarah, and then in 13 it says, all these died in faith. Kind of gives us the summary and the conclusion. The psalmist gives us a rhetorical question in Psalm 89:48. What man is he that liveth and shall not see death? John 3:13, I think, answers this rhetorical question. No man hath ascended unto the Father. And the answer is, but he who came down from heaven, and the Son of Man. All have seen death. So we have a double assurance that Enoch died. First by the expression that he was not, and secondly from a direct statement in the 13th chapter of Hebrews, establishing that he died. Well, let's go to Hebrews 11:5, which is our problematic verse. But let me do an aside first. Let's turn for Romans, the 5th chapter. Because there have been some that have said, well, I don't think he died. I think he's nestled away somewhere safely. We'll give you one more evidence that I think supports this understanding that he did actually die. And we start in Romans 5, 12 through 14. Therefore, just as though through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus spread to all men, because all have sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin was not imputed when there was no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, except for Enoch. That's not what it says. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses. And I think this is another biblical proof that in fact he did die. Convinced? Well, then how do we handle this translation? Well, turning back to Hebrews 11:5, we find, by faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death, and was not found because God had translated him. Before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. Let's look at a couple of other translations of that, because obviously we may not be getting a clear meaning here. If we accept the fact that he did die, what does this mean? According to the New International Version, rather than using translated, it says, taken from this life. According to Fenton, it meant to pass over. According to Moffat, it is rendered taken away. And if we look this word up in vines, It means to transfer to another place or to remove from the scene. It's a change of position. Translating means to be transposed or to have changed nature. Any of us that have gone overseas, we did so this summer for the first time, realize what translation is all about. Enoch was translated. Was there anyone else in the Old Testament that was translated? Brother Dan, was there anyone else that was translated? Elijah is described as translated. And what happened there? He was translated or removed by the Lord that he might not experience death at the hands of a very, very, very corrupt generation. Bill Clinton's got nothing on Jezebel and Ahab. They were bad. These were corrupt people that were out to destroy him. And he was removed from the scene. The mantle passed. We have another group where translation is described, and we almost touched on this a little bit in the panel when we talked about 1 Corinthians 15, 51 and 52. I show you a mystery, that we shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed, and this is the same word as translated, in the moment, in the twinkling of an eye. And the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed or translated. The church is also promised this in the very last day. And it requires a change for the church, does it not? A change from a fleshly body to a spiritual body. Because that's the arrangement with the church. It really lays an example for us of something we might describe as the principle of divine escape. Enoch had served his purpose, and the Lord took him out of that situation. Now, we realize that at the time of the flood, right before Noah, it was a very evil and corrupt time. And there were fallen angels, and there were the mighty men on earth. Maybe some of that was starting to approach him because he was taking heat for his prophecy. And so this might be an example of that principle of divine escape. Escape from a time when there were no longer hearing ears. Let us continue. This was a time when I think Enoch's life was in mortal danger. It was also a time when his message was not being received. And it seems reasonable that God ushered him into the grave so that he would not be taken. He denied them that. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Genesis 5:24. He was also, as we will describe, in his prime during this time. Now, if the average patriarch lived 920 years, did you ever hear about dog years? I always get in trouble when I talk about this because someone doesn't understand dog years. Our dog is 4 years old. 5 years old. Can't keep track of his birthdays. So in people years, he's about 35 years old. So that's dog years. Let's do that same kind of interpretation for Enoch. Enoch died at the age of what? 365 years. The average person lived 920. If we equate that to a 70-year life now, which is just about accurate at the end of the age, I mean, it's a little higher here, but probably worldwide 70, and that's the description that's given us in the scriptures. If we do a proportion there, Enoch would have been in our years 27 years old. What do you call a person that's 27 years old? A kid? Brethren, we're aging. We call that in their prime, right? These are robust, youthful, strong individuals. Starting out their lives. So relatively, Enoch was relatively a young man. And if you have questions about dog years, you can come up and talk to me afterwards. But the point is that he was a relatively young man. And he certainly, we feel, would have been killed by his contemporaries. So there's four things we know for sure anyway in looking at this. His body was not found. His lifespan relative to the others on the scene was short. He didn't, as a consequence, really see corruption of age. You know, when you're 27, the majority of people are strong, right? And healthy. Not all, but the majority. So he didn't see the corruption of age that obviously Adam and the others were starting to see. God was involved in this transformation or taking away process, whatever that translation was. And as we have already noted and feel, there's pretty convincing evidence he actually did die. So we suggest that this translation meant ushering him into a hiding place, the same hiding place that Job begged to be taken. Remember that? Hide me in the grave. Hide me in the pit. And so we feel that that was what took place. So what do we know? What do we know? We know that his name meant dedicated or consecrated. We know that he was seventh in the lineage from Adam. We know that he had sons and daughters. He was fruitful. We know that he was a hero of faith. That's how we got into this in the start. We know that he walked with God and by implication did it during in an ungodly world. We know that he prophesied about the Lord returning to judge the world. And this was not a popular message, obviously. We know that he lived 365 years, not 360, but 365. We know that he died at a relatively young age. We know that he was taken or translated, and we know that he's described as one of the ancient worthies. That's what we know. Now think about those facts. You know, the pastor often cautions us about making things a type. So we're just going to suggest what he might picture. Once again, we're going to look at what we know and what this might indicate in this picture. His name means initiated, dedicated, or consecrated. He was the son of Jared, whose name meant descent, going down. His son Methuselah's name meant when he dies it shall be sent, showing the flood. He was the seventh generation from Adam, seven being a perfect what? Heavenly number. He lived 365 years, not, you know, if you said 360, we would have said Jewish year, right? We'd latch onto that. But what is 365? It's a Gentile calendar, is it not? He walked with God and had a special fellowship relationship with him. He had communication with God. He was on that plane in. He was a hero of faith. He prophesied the Lord's return to do what? To establish his kingdom and ultimately to have judgment upon the world. He was persecuted by a corrupt generation. He pleased God with both his faith and his obedience. He was faithful even unto death. And he was taken away by God. What do you think he pictures? You know, in my mind, I can't help but think that he pictures the church. He was born of descending flesh. He was dedicated. He was that perfect number, the seventh generation. He was taken from amongst Gentiles. He walked with God. His foundation was faith. He pleased God amidst a corrupt generation and witnessed actively. He was faithful unto death. And he was hidden in a very special way that he might not see corruption or impurity. To me, it seems inescapable that this is a very wonderful picture, and I think this is why it's presented in this 11th chapter of Hebrews. He's a wonderful example of faith. Not in the gospel age, but during the patriarchal age. So the question remains, who was that hero? He was a hero and an example for the church at the end of the age. Hopefully, each of us has a little better understanding of why he's listed in this chapter. Hopefully, we will see the aspects of his life that we are being called to emulate. Because, you know, God is very, very consistent. What he expected of these who walked back then are the same attributes he expects of his footstep followers, those called not unto friendship, but unto sonship, to emulate today. We are excited about gleaning these things and learning a little bit more about one of these heroes of faith. Hebrews 11:13. All these died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and they were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed them, and they were strangers and pilgrims in the land. A hero of faith. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly, and this is what we desire. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. What a privilege. We know based on Hebrews 11:6 that without faith it is impossible to please God. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and is the rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Isn't that every one of our convictions? None of us have seen God, and yet we believe in him, and we believe in his plans to the very depths of our heart, to the point to where we forsake wealth, we forsake families, we forsake other worldly advantage. We are solidified by our faith. Faith is the basis of our hope. It is the song of our desire. It is the energizing force of our daily walk. Like Enoch, we desire to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God in total zeal and dedication. For from him and through him and to him be the glory forever. Amen.